fellow true crime lovers. Welcome to another episode of Dimes of Crime. I'm your host, Richa.
And I'm Haley.
How's it going? Haley is drunk, by the way. I just want to say that.
This is going to be a really fun episode
because I'm really excited for drunk Haley all the time. And so I'm very excited that you guys get to see her today.
Yes. I feel like I'm on the spot, but yes, welcome to Drunk Haley.
What did you drink or what are you drinking, Haley?
Well, right now I'm drinking a seltzer water, but prior to this I had three old fashions, a green tea shot, and a zipper shot.
I have no idea what that is. Haley is the alcohol expert, so she might have to explain what that is.
You just call me an alcoholic.
I called you an alcohol expert. You're the mixers in the family because you guys know the bartending stuff.
That's true. A zipper shot is Chambord and vodka and what else, Connor? He's not answering me because his headphones are on.
Okay. Well, anyways, so Haley had fun for drinks today. And I have a glass of red wine, my usual modus operandi. This time it's Vital Vineyards red wine. So it's nice. I like it. Mine is more mellow. So our week has been touch and go. I know we posted on Instagram that life's been a struggle bus for both of us. We haven't really been able to get into recording our episodes because of time difference or work or scheduling or whatever is going on, just life in general. But somehow Haley and I are making it work today, which is yay. So I think we might be on schedule for Thursday. So you guys might hear this on June, what day will it be? 16th? Maybe? Maybe? We'll see.
Yeah.
But if not...
Maybe, if I can get through editing done.
Yeah, but if not, we will get it out at some point. So thank you for being patient with us. And let's get into it. All the disclaimers apply before I get into the story. We're going to talk about gory details. This one might be a little bit more gorier than the usual. I always say that, but it might be. And then we are going to talk about some racial components in this case as well. So I just want to point out that these are not true portrayals of how obviously Haley and I think or what we feel, but this was part of the case that today that I'm going to talk about, and so it will come up. So if that's something that bothers you, maybe fast forward. I'll try to give as much of a warning when I mention that.
Yep. Perfect.
All right, so let's get into it today.
Also, yeah. Hold on. I wanted to point out that we'll probably be doing our launch days on Thursdays instead of Tuesdays, which I know we posted on our social media, but there's more listeners than we have social media followers. So for those who do not follow us on social media, our launch days will be Thursdays instead of Tuesdays. We accidentally posted on a Thursday last week and it showed a very much more
receptive audience,
range of listeners. Yes, thank you. Than Tuesdays.
Yeah.
So that will be our new launch day is Thursdays.
Yeah, it was a happy accident. We liked it. Okay, so today we are going to be talking about probably the deadliest criminal accomplice in American history. Do you want to take a guess at who it is, Haley?
The deadliest? Bonnie and Clyde.
Criminal accomplice. Nope. But good guess. Is we're going to be talking about Susan Atkins. Mm. And if this name sounds familiar to you guys, it's because it's mostly mentioned in the background in relation to Charles Manson. Most people know bits and pieces about the Manson family and the horrors committed by the group that rocked the nation back in the 70s. Well, we are going to dive deep into one of the Charlie's Angels. Get it? Charlie's Angels,
yeah,
like the movie, but also because they're a part of Charles Manson's crew. I'm actually pretty proud of that name. It's probably what we're gonna call the episode, so just FYI, I'm very, very proud of that. So I'm just gonna toot my own horn here a little bit. Anyway, moving on,
because I really thought when you said Charlie's Angels, so Charlie's Angels.
That was a good one. Why didn't I think of that? Ooh, maybe next one. Maybe you should do that one. Anyways, so moving on, let's go back in time to May 7th, 1948 in San Gabriel, California. It was the day Susan Denise Atkins was born to Edward John Atkins and Jean Frances Jett. According to Susan, both her parents were alcoholics and her childhood was filled with volatility. Susan had one older brother, John Michael Atkins, and a younger brother, Stephen. She was abused and molested by her older brother, John, which, can I just say, absolutely breaks my heart. Most of the sources actually didn't go into detail about why her older brother, John, did that to her. Was there any residual mental health impact on him from his parents being alcoholics? Did his dad beat him after getting drunk? Absolutely nothing. Zip, zilch. I had no idea why he did that. Was he taking something out on his sister? I don't know. But I can't imagine being a little girl and being abused by your own brother, who you naturally want to look up to and look often to for protection. Same thing I think about when parents or moms or fathers abuse their kids. It's like someone who should naturally protect you and your family ends up hurting you that badly, has to have a deep mental impact on you. Not to mention, it's just heartbreaking. Anyway, moving on. Until she was 13 years old, Atkins and her family lived in a middle-class home in the Cambrian Park area of San Jose, California. People who knew her described her as a quiet, self-conscious girl who belonged to her school's glee club and the local church choir. When Susan was about 14 years old, her mother died of cancer. 2 weeks before her mother was hospitalized for the final time, Susan actually arranged for members of her church choir to sing Christmas carols under her bedroom window. After Jean's death, relatives were asked to help look after Susan and her brothers, Steve and John. Edward, her father, was in the Navy when their mom passed, and so Susan was expected to be the motherly figure in the family looking after everyone. Her father eventually moved to Los Banos, California with Susan and her younger brother, Steve, because he had found work in the San Luis Dam construction project. I'm assuming John, her older brother, was over at 18 at this time and probably had moved out, but the sources don't really mention why it was just Susan and her younger brother moving with Edward, so I don't have that answer, and I'm just guessing at this point, so don't quote me. As you would have thought, Edward often left the two children, Susan and Steve, behind to fend for themselves. Again, I just feel so much sadness when I hear stories about children who never get to experience love and nurturing from their parents. I'm not saying this is an excuse for Susan to go ahead and do what she does in the future, but I'm just simply stating that as a mother and a parent, that this absolutely devastates me. All a child needs is love and nurturing, and the fact that there are children in this world that don't get that is beyond heartbreaking to me.
It's very sad. I don't understand. Yeah.
It makes me just want to go and hug Leo when he's sleeping. When I'm researching these cases and I read these things and my child is napping or sleeping like he is right now, it makes me want to go wake him up and hug him really tight.
Yeah, I feel you.
Susan eventually took up a job during her junior year in high school to support herself and her younger brother, Stephen. Because of the instability in her life and absent parents, her grades obviously started to slip in high school. I don't mean obviously like there are people in the situation who don't redeem themselves, but in this case, she just has so much going against herself that the grades starting to slip in high school probably is the first telltale sign of that. In December of 1966, Susan asked two of her classmates to move to go to San Francisco with her over Christmas break. Not move, just go to San Francisco. No one agrees, and so Susan leaves to go to San Francisco by herself and never returned to Los Banos to finish off her senior year in high school. I have to mention here that the 70s in California, especially San Francisco, was in the middle of a countercultural revolution that would rock America. It's here that the hippie culture was born, and the idea of living in communes and doing drugs such as LSD was not just common, but a lifestyle that many young men and women were attracted to at this time. San Francisco saw a huge surge of transients from all part of the country. So the fact that Susan wanted to go to San Francisco is not a random thought. I'm just providing background as to why she probably mentioned San Francisco at this time. The hippie culture, I'm using that term because that's actually what it was called at the time. And
right.
It promoted love and unity and, you know, free living and free thought. And that's probably what I'm guessing attracted Susan to that, because she'd longed belonging and that love
to
and
Charles Manson
affection. Yeah.
I we've talked about cults before. We've talked right. about like what's involved in cults, and it's very oddly close to what's involved in religion. Not to get them confused, but there's some similarities and some differences.
There are. I do want to mention, though, that the hippie culture or the revolution that I'm talking about, it was sort of perverted and polluted by the things that Charles Manson and his family did. But I'm not undermining what that revolution was about. It wasn't about destruction and violence like Charles Manson disguised it to be. It was actually about love and free spirit and belonging and all the other good stuff. And Charles Manson, we'll talk about this later in the case, he just kind of rides under the radar of that wave in San Francisco.
He was good at grooming young women and...
Did you read my notes, love, Haley?
Love bombing. No, but I recently have listened to a Charles Manson case.
Interesting. Okay. So San Francisco saw a surge of transients from all part of the country, which is probably why Susan was attracted to go to San Francisco as well. I'm sure after being tired of her sad, loveless life back home with an absent father who didn't seem to care, it didn't really seem appealing anymore. And for her, it was worth finding a sense of belonging somewhere else. She supported herself working odd jobs. She started with answering the phones for a company peddling magazine subscriptions. Living in a rented room, Susan was obviously lonely and depressed. She eventually quit the telemarketing job and became a waitress at a local coffee shop where she met two escaped convicts. Smitten, she went on the road with them, and the trio eventually were arrested in Oregon after committing a series of bank robberies. For her role in these crime sprees, Susan was in prison for 90 days and eventually put on probation. She eventually returned to San Francisco and became a topless dancer and also resorted to selling drugs to make ends meet. In autumn of 1967, about a year after she had left her old life back in Los Baños, Susan and her friend Ella Jo Bailey were living with two men in an apartment at the intersection of Oak and Lyon in San Francisco. About that same time in the year, Susan happened to attend a party where she met a man with long hair, prison tattoos on his forearms, playing and serenading people with his guitar. Haley knows who this man is, and she was drawn to him like a moth to a flame. 2 days later, she met the same man, a 32-year-old Charles Manson. Dun, dun, dun. She followed him home where, according to one of the sources that I read, I quote, he took off her clothes, placed her in front of a full-length mirror, told her she was beautiful, and made love to her, end quote. Now, keep in mind, Susan has gone her entire life not knowing any kind of affection, not knowing any kind of loving attention. And so I'm sure when she meets Charles Manson, who tells her that she's beautiful and makes love to her, she obviously falls for it. It's the attention and the sense of belonging that she'd been craving for a long time. And like Haley said before, it's probably what drew her to Charles Manson to begin with, because she was looking for that male figure to attach herself to who would take care of her. And Charles Manson, on the other hand, who I'm not going to go into many details about, but if you are interested, Haley can obviously, she heard a recent Charles Manson podcast. She might be able to tell you who did it, but there's tons and tons of resources and materials out there about Charles Manson if you guys are interested. Anyway, so when she meets Charles Manson, a serial manipulator, narcissist, and now famously known serial killer, she was the prime target for someone like him. He knew exactly how to groom her and what she craved from him to have her wrapped around his fingers in no time. After that encounter with Charles, he asked her to travel with him and three other women, Mary Brunner, Lynette Fromm, and Patricia Krenwinkel, who he was living with in an old school bus.
What's one that's known as Squeaky?
I think that's Lynette. Actually, no, that's Lynette. None of them, Lynette. Actually. That's Leslie Van Houten, I think. She comes later. I'm not sure. I didn't read, go into too much detail about Manson and his family. I focused solely on Susan Atkins. So I'm not, yeah, so I'm not entirely
I don't
sure.
Feel like you get a lot of episodes on the women involved, you know?
Yeah. And so I thought everyone talks about Charles Manson and no one really talks about his followers, a lot of them being women who committed these grisly crimes. And I feel like it's important to take a step back. And there is a part of me that understands that in rationality, these women were groomed and they were manipulated by Charles Manson. But at what point, and this is a question I ask myself, at any point we did a cult case or I've listened mm-hmm. to a cult case, does it become your choice to do that? There has to be a point right. where your morality or conscience kicks in and goes, this is wrong. And as you're doing that, you know it's wrong, but you're making the decision to do it anyway. And so I mm-hmm. feel like it's a very easy cop out to say, oh, Charles Manson manipulated them. But no, all these women made the choice to do what they did at the end of the day, I feel like.
Right. Enough is enough.
You know? Yeah, like I don't think Charles Manson can be their cop out. He didn't hold a gun to their head and say, you have to do this or else. A lot of them, they just did it for whatever reason. They believed him or believed what he was saying or wanted to listen to him. Whatever the reason, I'm not sure. I'm not in their shoes, but it was a very conscious decision to do it or not. Anyways, so he invites Susan to live with him and these three other women in an old school bus that he wanted to travel around the country with. She obviously says yes. And that is the fateful moment when she becomes part of the infamous Manson family. For those who don't know, and this is where I'm going to go into a little bit of detail about Manson and his background, because I think it is important in this case. We're not going to talk about him too much because we're a female-only crime podcast. But like I said, yeah, if you guys are interested, there's tons of material.
It's definitely important.
Yeah, there's tons of material about him. So if you guys are more interested and more intrigued about it, obviously read it. And I will list all my sources.
Also, if you're listening to this podcast, you don't know who Charles Manson is, like, wake up.
If you don't know who Charles Manson is, I envy your life because I envy the mind that doesn't know what these horrible people have done in the world. Anyways, so Manson family was the name of the commune of people that including Charles Manson and a bunch of other, I think at his max capacity, I think he had over 100 followers that lived together in the same area as a commune.
It's crazy.
I don't know how you find a house in San Francisco that could fit 100 people. How do you do that?
Wait, so you know that one of the Beach Boys let him live in a mansion with all his followers.
I read that somewhere very briefly in my source, and I wanted to dig more into it. But like I said, I only focused on Susan's part. So right. I did not mm-hmm. know that. I did read that he had a connection to one of the Beach Boys who was enthralled by Manson. Apparently one of the songs was even that the Beach Boys yes. did.
Charles Manson wrote it.
Yeah. And I guess he never got the credit for it or something weird like that. And he got really upset about it. I think that's right.
So very briefly, Charles Manson was obsessed with music, which is kind of like where it started all. And then I forget where they were living before, but they moved to LA or San Francisco, and then they met the Beach Boys, and then the Beach Boys showed him to their producer. And then, you know the movie, something Hollywood has Brad Pitt in it?
Nope, ringing no bells.
It's about the Manson family and the whole scenario that's about to unfold.
Oh, interesting.
But he lives with the Beach Boys man in the one of the Beach Boys mansions, and then his cult gets too big, and they're like, okay. So then somehow he gets evolved in living on a movie set.
Yeah, I think that was the Spawn Ranch or something. I'm gonna talk about that very briefly, but yeah, so that's good.
I think it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the name of the movie.
Oh,
but there's Brad Pitt in it. And
oh, that's the one that people said didn't make sense. I didn't know that was about Manson family. I'm gonna have to rewatch that or watch it, period. Now that makes me want to watch that movie.
It 100% makes sense if you know the Manson family
story. Oh, interesting. Because my parents, I think, went and watched that movie and they were like, that was a really weird movie. It did not make any sense. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess if you don't like the movie, I won't watch it. It had such a good cast, though. So I never even attempted to watch it. But now I'm very intrigued. Maybe I'll watch it. Okay. Anyway, so quickly going back. The Manson family was the name of the commune of people that were living together, apparently, in a Beach Boy mansion. And they eventually do move to this movie set that was a ranch. Manson flew under the radar of the hippie movement to push drugs that further helped him control his followers. I'm not going to go into too much detail about Charles Manson here. But like I said, if you are interested, there's a ton of material out there on him and his crimes. Apparently, Haley knows a lot. So DM her if you want to. The way it relates to this case is that it was allegedly under the manipulation of Charles Manson and being under the influence of LSD and some other hardcore drugs that he was able to manipulate some of his core followers to commit some heinous crimes under the pretense of a non-existent race war that Charles had convinced his followers of. I am going to talk about race stuff in the next few, like probably 10 minutes or so. So again, if that's a trigger for you guys, please fast forward or whatever suits your pleasure at that time. Over the next 2 years,
Charles Manson was a racist.
He definitely was. I did not know that either. So I learned myself a lot about Charles Manson by trying to research this case. Anyways, over the next 2 years, Susan fell deeper and deeper into the persuasive hold of Manson. She took on the name of Sadie Mae Glutz. This wasn't uncommon in the Manson family, and as Haley mentioned, we have done a cult case before. I think naming people something different than their actual identity is very common in cults and in narcissistic behaviors, because it sort of not just dehumanizes them, it breaks them away from their individual identity and forms a new identity just around themselves. And so I think it helps them gain more control than they would have had without that name being. It's a name that only Charles called her, right? And only the people in that family called her. So anyways, Charles gave all his followers a family name. At some point, Susan and the rest of the Manson followers were convinced that Charles was Jesus himself. Narcissist much. I also did not know that about him, where he thought he was Jesus. She also had a son born on October 7, 1968. Charles was not the father, if you're interested, but he got to name the son too. Barf. He called the son, I'm going to try my best to pronounce this. He called the son Zadfrak Glutz. That was a tongue twister. I will spell it out in my notes somewhere or like on an Instagram post somewhere if you guys are interested. Also, it will be listed in my sources.
So I don't know how much you're going to go into this, but in the Manson family, it wasn't uncommon for Charles Manson to offer the women followers up to other men. So
yeah, he was prostituting.
A lot of them were his kids. So there was multiple kids in the Charles Manson family, but a lot of them were his kids and a lot of them were not. And only DNA could tell that later on.
Oh, interesting. Well, my sources said that this guy was not.
Probably DNA proof.
Yeah, that someone else was the father. I don't remember his names. I want to say it was someone called Bruce. But anyways, I honestly don't remember the name. So if you're Bruce and I just named you, I'm sorry. So he called the son Zezo Sose Zadfrak Glutz. Wow. During the summer of 1969, now this is merely 9 months after Susan's given birth, the Manson family was attracting the attention of the police. They were suspected of stealing cars and also of housing underage minors. And I think this is where Leslie Van Houten comes into play, because she is another teenager that is briefly mentioned in this case that I'm going to talk about. But I don't talk about her a lot. And maybe she was called Squeaky, but I'm not sure.
No, it was Lena.
Oh, okay. That were so house, and they so stealing cars. Police were had them suspected of stealing cars and of housing underage minors that were being prostituted as well. Manson also encouraged drug dealing as a way to raise money for the family. Now, I didn't mention it here, but since Haley mentioned it, that they lived on a ranch at this time in the summer of 1969. Wow, summer of 69. That's like the song. Is that what it's based on? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyways, that was a random thought. Anyways, so in the summer of 69, they're living on a ranch, which my sources described as a movie set. So I'm assuming this is the same ranch that Haley mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so Manson was living here and the police were starting to circle him and his commune living at this ranch at the time. And he's starting to get more and more paranoid. So with the police circling his commune, and his paranoia about a non-existent racial war against a group he called the Black Panthers was growing. According to a source, I quote, Manson wanted to manipulate police and subsequently the media into believing black organizations such as the Black Panthers, who were against police brutality, were responsible for the crimes, end quote. These were crimes that he was manipulating his followers into doing. The source also mentions, I quote, Manson viewed the Panthers as well as black Muslims as threats and believed blacks were inferior. He hoped a race war would lead blacks and whites to kill one another, with blacks eventually leading themselves to destruction, end quote. Like I said, these are not thoughts that I agree with or opinions that I agree with, but I do have to provide background on what Manson was telling his followers, and this is what he's brainwashing them with. And I think it was, not I think, according to my sources, it's in order to spark this racial war that he thinks in his mind is going to happen, that he convinced these followers to commit certain crimes to frame these Black Panthers, and I'm putting them in quotes.
Right.
Anyways.
So first he convinces everybody that he is Jesus, and then he convinces everybody that there's a racial war coming out, and the only way that they can win this racial war is if they follow him. Like, yeah. He is going to be the salvation, and they are the only ones who are going to survive them between the black people.
That's crazy. Okay.
Words from Charles Manson, not me.
Wow. Crazy dude. Anyways, so the first murder in which Susan Atkins had a hand in was that of a music teacher, Gary Hinman, whom Bobby Boussolet, who was another member of the family, and I'm so sorry if I butchered that name, another member of the Manson family, Bobby, he had lived with this music teacher before, so he knew him. That was the family's connection to Gary Hinman. Hinman, on the other hand, also was a drug manufacturer and allegedly had whipped up a batch of LSD that Bobby had then sold for $1,000 to members of a bike gang. The bikers later claimed that the LSD was of poor quality and they wanted their money back. On July 25th, 1969, Susan, Mary Brunner, and Bobby allegedly accompanied Charles and went to Gary's home in the hopes to get their money back to give back to the bikers. But when Gary refused to refund the cash, claiming the LSD he sold them was actually potent, Manson allegedly sliced his ear off with a sword. I paused at this one because the sources literally said he swung the sword so hard that he sliced the ear off. Either way, he swung it so hard and so fast and so close to his face that it sliced his ear off. That would like creep me out. Also, I'm pronouncing,
and actually I've never heard that before, so that's news to me.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Pat on my back to myself. Anyway, so
it's always crazy how many times you hear a case and it's still like new every time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's funny. I thought I knew so much about Charles Manson, but when I sat down and thought about it, I only know bits and pieces. I don't really know the entirety of the Charles Manson case. And after researching this case, maybe I want to research a little bit more, but that'll have to be of another time. It actually does have some very depressing things about it that I'm not ready to research
right now. And since you researched it, you should listen to Once upon a time in Hollywood, because that whole movie will make complete sense.
Yeah, I think I'm going to watch that movie now. Maybe that'll be a lighter version of actually researching the case myself, because unlike anything else, I'm very proud of myself. It was all reading articles and written sources. I'm very much about audio and visual sources, and I've listened to no podcasts and watched no documentaries about Charles Manson or Susan Atkins to go through this. Not even like a YouTube clip or anything, just all written. Anyway, so Manson apparently slices his ear off and then exits the house. The remaining crew, which is Susan, Mary, and Bobby, continue to hold him hostage for 3 days. Gary still refused to come up with the cash. So on the third day, and it's unclear who, but either Susan or Bobby stabbed him. He was also then proceeded to be suffocated by all three of them. And by that, I mean Susan, Mary, and Bobby all took turns suffocating him to death. Susan then wrote, I quote, "political piggy" in Gary's blood on the walls before they left the house. So after they killed him, after she or Bobby stabbed him, she put her fingers in his blood and wrote "political piggy" with his blood on the walls. That is insanity to me. I'm not whatever.
Disgusting.
Yeah. It's like on a different level. I don't even know what to say about that. Anyways, all of this background that I just went into converges on the fateful night of August 8th, 1969, when the brutal killings of Sharon Tate, Wojciech Frykowski, and Abigail Folger took place. There was a fourth person there that I will mention, but this case was huge back in 1969, and I'll go into more detail about it. So for those of you who don't know, and I didn't because I moved here from India, so I didn't know who Sharon Tate was or why she was famous. Sharon Tate was an upcoming actress married to filmmaker Roman Polanski. Her best known movie was The Valley of the Dolls, released in 1967. In the summer of 1969, Sharon was 8 months pregnant with her and Roman's baby, and they were renting a house at 150 Cielo Drive in a posh Benedict Canyon neighborhood of Los Angeles. While Roman was in Europe, his friend Wojciech Frykowski and Abigail Folger, and if Abigail's last name seems familiar to you, it's because she is indeed the heiress, or was indeed the heiress of the Folger Coffee Empire. They were both staying with Sharon at Sharon's and Roman's house that they were renting in LA, while Roman was out of town in Europe. On August 8th, 1969, Charles Manson ordered his followers Susan, Charles Tex Watson, who I will only call Tex, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Linda Kasabian to go to the Cielo Drive home and kill everyone there. I quote, "as gruesome as you can," end quote. Manson knew of the house from Terry Melcher, who was a music producer and had decided against giving Charles a recording contract because of his erratic behavior. Charles had allegedly convinced his followers that these murders had to be committed in an attempt to frame the Black Panthers and to reveal to the world their true nature for violence and their intent to start this race war. When Tex...
But little did Manson know that he had sold the house to Sharon Tate.
That's correct. Actually, I read somewhere that he was there. He wanted to ask Terry Melcher if he could live in this house. But when he goes there to do that, apparently that's when he crossed paths with Sharon Tate and Roman. Because they were moving into the house when he had gone to do that. But I'm not sure. I very briefly read that, so I'm not sure if it's true. So I don't know if he actually went there to kill Terry Melcher or if he really did know that Sharon Tate. I have no idea. I'm not sure. But anyways, so he's basically building up this night for the Susan, Tex, Linda, and Patricia, and telling them we have to go and kill them because we have to bring the world attention to this race war. And the only way to do that is to frame the Black Panthers for a murder. And this is the murder we're going to frame them for. So when Tex, Susan, Linda, and Patricia arrived at the house, they were met by a Stephen Parent, an 18-year-old boy who had been visiting the estate's caretaker in the guest house. Hex shot Stephen to death, and Susan, Patricia, and Linda proceeded to break into the house. The home at the time had Sharon Tate, Wojcik, and Abigail living there, but a celebrity hairstylist, Jay Sebring, who was also a close friend of Sharon's, was also there that night. Susan, with a knife in her hand, ordered all the occupants, and by that I mean all four, Sharon, who is 8 months pregnant, Jay, her celebrity hairstylist friend, Wojcik, and Abigail to gather in the living room. She also helped the other followers of Manson tie the occupants' hands together by ropes around their necks. When Wojcik tried to fight Susan out of the restraints, she stabbed him several times and wrestled him to the ground. Keep in mind, all of this is happening around an 8-month-old woman. At some point, I believe Susan was yelling at Sharon when Jay, her hairstylist friend, tried to plead on her behalf and mentioned that she was pregnant and that they could take whatever they wanted, but to please leave Sharon alone, as the stress wasn't good for her or the baby. Tex shot and stabbed Jay to death for pleading for Sharon. While Tex was stabbing Jay, Wojcik and Abigail managed to escape the ties and they ran out, but both of them were chased down and killed by Patricia and Linda. I think I read somewhere they were each stabbed 50 or more than 50 times, which is an insane amount of rage.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the end, according to Susan's own confession, she stated that she stabbed Sharon, thereby killing her 8-month unborn child. I quote, "I was sick of listening to her pleading and begging, begging and pleading," end quote. She told Sharon Tate that she, I quote, "didn't care about her, had no mercy on her," end quote, and also called her a bitch and licked Sharon's blood off of her hand.
Oh, disgusting.
Yeah. As they were leaving this brutal murder scene, Susan wrote the words pig on the wall using Sharon Tate's blood as a way to frame the Black Panthers. Sounds familiar, because she did the same thing or similar thing at Gary Hinman's house. She wrote political piggies there and she writes pig here. I know none of this makes sense, but Charles was a master manipulator, and all of them being hardcore on drugs like LSD didn't help much of their senses. And again, I'm not taking away their agency of choice. I do think that Susan is 100% responsible for these crimes and her actions in these crimes. And to just blame Charles Manson as a manipulator, I think, is a huge cop out. So anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just annoys me when people just encompass all of these crimes under Charles Manson. I feel like that's diminishing the accountability for all these other followers who partook in these crimes.
Yeah, that's a hard one, but it's like, I don't know. I really don't know, because I don't want to get too deep into it, but, you know, manipulation is manipulation, and manipulation has proven to make you do crazy things. Yet murder is still murder, and you should be held responsible for the crimes that you commit.
Yeah, it's definitely not black and white. I'm not stating it is black and white. I'm simply stating that the people who actually murdered the people have to be held accountable for their actions, right? Just that right. part. So the media obviously had a frenzy around these murders, because Sharon Tate was an upcoming actress in Hollywood at the time. But when nothing in the media was mentioned linking the murders to Black Panthers, it only enraged Charles Manson. So on the following night, on August 9th, 1969, Charles took Susan, Patricia, and Linda, as well as Leslie Winhouten, who was barely a teenager at that time, and Stephen Clem Grogan, in search for more people to murder and intentionally frame the Black Panthers. They finally selected the home of grocery store executive Leno LaBianca and his wife Rosemary. Charles and Susan tied the couple up and robbed them. Manson then left Susan and the others to stab the couple to death. And by this, I mean all of the followers who were there with Charles Manson at the time took turns stabbing the couple numerous times. I mean, that is huge amount of rage. Huge amount of rage.
Right. Usually you see that stuff with, like, lovers and really
something super personal, but still it's just so much rage regardless of it being personal or not. The energy it takes to stab someone 50 something times, it's a lot of energy. So anyways, they ended the night again with writing on the walls with their blood. I don't exactly know what they wrote on the walls this time, but they did write in the victims' bloods on the walls again. The cases went cold for a few months, but when Susan was arrested with some of the other Klan members on auto theft charges that I mentioned earlier that police had suspected the family of, she blabbed about the murders to the other inmates at Sybil-Brand, the women's jail in L.A., which eventually led to law enforcement solving these murders 3 months later. In December 1969, Susan was the star witness at the grand jury for the Manson family and again bragged about her homicidal exploits. I read somewhere that she went back and forth on her confessions a lot and what her actual contribution and what her actions were on the night of these murders that we're talking about. So it's debated and thought that Susan likely did not actually stab Sharon Tate, even though she says this in interviews multiple times and she says that in front of the jury multiple times, but she also recanted this confession multiple times. So the debate is that she didn't stab her. It was actually Tex who stabbed Sharon because Susan actually froze when Tex asked her to stab her. And that Tex pushed her aside and went over to finish the job himself. That is, however, again, I'm not saying that she wasn't directly involved in their deaths. Whether you partook or not, she was there watching these crimes happen. So regardless of whatever is going on, she's still assisting in these murders and actively participating, and by not stopping them, she is an active participant in my mind. So Susan was guilty of many crimes during the events at Gary's and Sharon's homes. She was found guilty of entrapment, kidnapping, theft, assault, and ultimately of murder. In a 1976 interview, so 7 years after these crimes, she had become a born-again Christian. Atkins, or Susan, claimed that she did not actually stab anyone during the Tate murders and that Tex Watson was responsible for the murder of Sharon Tate. And actually, in his 1978 memoir, Tex actually declared himself responsible for all of the injuries, characterizing Susan's initial confessions as exaggerations, jailhouse bragging, and basically a ploy for attention. She and Susan then married a young law student, James Whitehouse, while she was still incarcerated. One psychiatrist told the parole board in 2000, I quote, "I can only conclude based upon the inmate's behavior that she has a serious problem with authority and has assumed an extremely adversarial approach to the psychiatric evaluation," end quote. In 2008, while she was exercising at a gym in prison, she had a seizure. Sorry. It's late and I'm like mumbling now. She was rushed. She was rushed to the hospital where they actually diagnosed Susan with brain cancer.
Oh, dang.
She was moved to the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, that's just north of Fresno, and her health quickly declined after that. In 2009, her attorney slash husband, James Whitehouse, petitioned the courthouse for a compassionate release. He argued that her medical needs had far outweighed the sentence that she had received so many years ago and that she was now bedridden and unable to harm anyone. Former prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi wrote a letter to the board which read in part, I quote, "Just because Susan Atkins showed no mercy to her victims, we therefore are duty-bound to follow her inhumanity and show no mercy to her," end quote. Deborah Tate, the sister of Sharon Tate, told Larry King in an interview, I quote, "I have all the compassion in the world for her," and by her she means Susan. "I wish her very well and always have. In jail, I hope that they thrive and provide a useful life to other inmates, but I can never trust that these people are rehabilitated. I'm not capable of hate. I feel bad that their lives have been wasted, but that was a choice that they made." Fair enough. Quote. Susan was denied her compassionate release. She died in the prison in Chowchilla on September 24th, 2009. And that's it. That was the life of Susan Atkins. Susan Denise Atkins.
Dang. It's heavy.
Yeah. And hopefully this is information that people haven't covered as much. I'm sure other podcasts have covered Susan Atkins before.
Yeah, but I feel like in relation to Charles Manson, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I still mentioned Charles Manson.
Well, it's impossible.
But I really did want to focus on. Yeah. But I did want to mention Susan and just her participation in this. So hopefully you guys enjoyed that. Hopefully it's a new side of the coin to the Charles Manson case.
I think you did a good job. There are some things I never heard, and I've, you know, the Charles Manson's a well-known case.
Yeah. So yay. I hope you guys enjoyed, and we'll see when this episode comes out, but I'm very excited for when it does come out. So.
Yes.
All right. You know the drill.
Go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast. Leave us a review, send us a DM on any social media, or email us at dimesofcrime@gmail.com. And we will see you next week with a drink in hand.
Don't let the murder thoughts bite. Bye.